So could you just start by saying your name and what your current position is?
Yes, so my name is Daniel Prieto-Alhambra and I am a professor of pharmacon device epidemiology here at Oxford. I lead a group of people, it's a section called Health Data Sciences. So we basically use health data to produce knowledge and to, you know, try and improve human health.
Well, we're going to talk about that a lot more. But first, before that, I'd just like a little bit more about your background. So how did you first get interested in science and into this interesting branch of science, which, to be honest, I hadn't really come across before?
Yeah, so I am a medical doctor by training. So I trained as a GP. I practiced as a GP for a while. And then I kind of realized that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in how we manage disease in primary care, and also I would say beyond primary care. So I started doing a PhD into research methods, epidemiology, statistics, just to learn the basics of how we handle data to generate knowledge. So I did, the first one was, I did it in Spain where I'm from, in Barcelona. And then after that, I started my PhD, and as part of that, I had, you know, the fortune to spend a little bit more than a year here at Oxford as a visiting PhD student. And that was basically a project using existing data, routinely collected data, electronic medical records and the like from Spain and from the UK. To look at a number of musculoskeletal conditions like arthritis, basically, and also fractures and bone fragility problems. So yeah, basically, you know, through that kind of route, I ended up, you know, finding that my passion was more to generate data than to consume data as a clinician does in their day-to-day job. And although I have been practicing as a physician until very recently, basically, I believe that I am, you know, much better doing research than practicing as a clinician, and that's where I'm headed.
So this is, this is where I think it's really interesting. This is, so, you know, everybody knows about clinical trials where you take a treatment or a device and you test it on a population prospectively. What you're doing is looking at people who are going through the healthcare system and using the data on that that shows what drugs they've had and so on, analysing that retrospectively to try and come up with answers. How do you, can you give me some idea of the relative importance of both those two ways of doing things?
Yes, so I think unfortunately there's a little bit of a division in how people see this. Sometimes, you know, as one is good data, the other is bad data. I think they are very complementary, actually. The beauty of clinical trials, of course, is that you have very clean data on whatever outcome or whatever condition you want to look at. So you collect the information you need and you want. And additionally, you also have the beauty that you are randomizing people to receive a treatment or not, meaning that in the end, the treated and untreated groups are comparable. They are basically the same on everything you want to compare them except the treatment they received, and therefore any differences in outcomes, you know, can be referred to the treatment they received, right? In the data we use, that doesn't happen. We look at data as it comes from clinical practice, from routine practice. That has limitations, including the fact that people tend to take treatment for a reason. So those people are not necessarily comparable to the people who didn't receive the same treatment. That's what we usually call confounding. But also it has other limitations, including the fact that we use data that was collected in not always ideal conditions, right? So, you know, you can imagine in a GP practice when things are busy, potentially people will be coding things more quickly and less accurately. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done on kind of curating that data before you can use it for research. Now, the advantages of this kind of data that I don't think are, you know, preferable to trial data, but are complementary, first, that this kind of data includes, of course, anyone who goes through the healthcare system here in the NHS, even more so, because it's a kind of universal system, right? So you see basically people that have been excluded from trial participation for whatever reason, including comorbidities sometimes, or because they have a short lifespan, or because they are
pregnant
or very young, all those people, when exposed to a treatment, will turn up in our data. So we can collect information on what happened to them without exposing them to a risk, unless that happened because it was considered necessary through routine clinical practice. That's one key advantage, I believe. Two more key advantages are first the size of the data I can get hold of is, you know, an order of magnitude bigger, right? And that, of course, you know, in some situations it matters, especially when we're looking at safety outcomes that tend to be, of course, rare. We do need big numbers. And I think, of course, I think a very relevant example is the COVID vaccines, right? Where
we'll get to that, but yeah, let's not talk about COVID.
I think that's
just
a very
yet.
Good.
I'm doing general principles.
Yeah, that's a very good example. And then the final advantage, I think, is not only the number of people, but also the possibility to follow them up for much longer than a trial does, right? So a trial costs a lot of money. You follow people up for a certain time, but then you basically let go. In this kind of data, because the data is generated as people go through the healthcare system, you can follow people up for as long as they were registered in the GP practice or for as long as they were having contact with the NHS. So that can be sometimes 10, 20 years of data available.
Now, you've mentioned you use both UK data and Spanish data and perhaps elsewhere in the world now, and you also used the word curate earlier.
Yeah.
So who curates these databases and how can you ensure consistency across different databases?
That's a very good question. indeed. So we have used data for many different topics, but very, very specially, very specifically for COVID. From many different parts of the world.
Let's not talk about COVID just yet, sorry.
So that data is typically initially pseudonymized, and you know, for kind of governance reasons, the data is, it has a first kind of process that's done by the data, you could call it vendor, data stewards, depending on the country they use different terminology, right? Mm. But it's basically the people who made the data available to researchers. Mm. Yeah.
And do these tend to be private companies or are they government based?
So in the UK, in Europe, mostly government based.
Yeah.
In the US, mostly private companies.
Yeah. Mm.
And then other parts of the world, it depends on the country. But I would say in Asia, I've used some Asian data, and with the exception of China, most of the other countries would be selling or making the data available through private routes. Mm. But in Europe, it's typically government-based institutions or trusted third parties, as they call them, right? So that's the first process. The second process is, of course, once you receive the data, you need to do all the checks to make sure that the data is fit for purpose, that you can use it, that it's got quality, completeness, and all that. Typically, that will be done by my team if I am directly accessing the data. And we do that for data that we've been using for many years, including, for instance, data from Spain or from the UK. Now, the third step in the process that you mentioned already is this interoperability, right? So making data basically similar across the world so you can do international collaboration when that is needed or when that is desirable. And that is something we've done a lot of work on recently in the last 3-5 years. This was just, you know, pure chance or serendipity. I don't know, just when the pandemic hit, we were already working on this topic of making data look the same across the globe, because all these data sets in a way contain similar information, right? It's going to be, you know, your social demographics, what conditions you have, what medicines you're taking, all that. But maybe recorded in different languages, in different systems. The format of the data is most likely going to be different as well. So there is this process of what we call mapping to a common data model, so to a common structure or format, which then enables international collaboration without moving data. So I can analyze data from the UK that I have mapped to this common data model. In this case, we use a common data model called OMOP. And then basically, if I have a collaborator in, say, Spain or in South Korea that has data in the same format, I can share my code, and that code should run in their data. And then all they can or have to share is results, really. So aggregated data, we don't move patient level data anymore. And that has many advantages in terms of, information governance and security, because you keep the data where it is. Mm. You have this version of the data that has been formatted in a very specific way, and then we can analyze it what we call in a federated manner. So we basically have someone writing the analytical code and then colleagues or collaborators running that code across the globe.
So you talked about size, the size of study. Mm-hmm. Typically, how many patients are represented in the kind of study you might do?
So Before the pandemic, we will be talking typically of tens of thousands of people. That was the usual. Nowadays, millions sometimes.
Mm. Mm. That's extraordinary. And before we get to COVID, we're going to get into it in just a minute. Yeah. But can you give me a couple of examples of the kind of question that you might have been asking about arthritis or...
So not related to COVID, right?
Not related to COVID. Yeah,
yeah, so let's go... I'll give you an example, pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, not related to COVID. Mm. So an example of something we were doing before the pandemic was looking at, and this is NIHR-funded research that is a senior fellowship that I am the awardee of myself. So we are looking at whether in very old, very elderly people who have lots of conditions, there's always this question on whether it's worth, it's considering at least stopping some of the treatments they are taking because they are deemed to be unsafe and maybe not that useful for them. And an example of that could be statins, for instance, right? So this is a question that's very tricky to investigate in a trial because you have these people who are taking the treatment and you have to randomize them to stop taking the treatment or not, and that's not something that, you know, is easy to convince people to do, right? So we were looking into that specific question of what happens when you stop one such treatment, what we call preventative therapies, you know.
And in the real world, some doctors might simply decide to make that change to their patient.
Yes, and ideally, you know, it's kind of an ideal scenario because there's so much uncertainty that it is to be expected in a way that those decisions are somewhat random, right? If you had very clear knowledge that, let's say, stopping therapies causes harm or it doesn't, then you can expect that everybody would be doing the same. But when you have these situations where you don't have very good evidence, there's more randomness in those decisions and you can leverage that to do this kind of observational research. That's an example, pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, we are doing...
And what was the outcome?
Sorry. So that's something we are still working on now, because we could talk about priorities, right? So in a way, that was deprioritized. It's looking like if you stop these therapies, you need to be careful because at least for some time after stopping them, there's going to be an increased risk of the events you were trying to prevent. So statins, for instance, will be heart attacks. But that's still something we are writing up now as we speak. Now, a post-pandemic example would be a lot of work we are doing on cancer. So looking at different presentations of different types of cancer, the prognosis of cancer, and then what does that look like before and after the pandemic? So that sort of observational study looking at prognosis and presentation of cancer, different types of cancer in the population and across Europe in this case.
And you mentioned risks earlier. So you, are there just these two main questions you're asking? Does this treatment work, this drug or this device work? And also, does this treatment or device do harm? Those are the two kinds of big questions you might be asking.
Well, so I think there's three types of research we do with this kind of big data, big health data. One indeed is looking at the effects of medical devices, procedures, treatments, medicines. And you can look at benefits and you can look at risks. Typically, we do more of the risk bit of the picture because that's what's harder to do with trial data because these are rare outcomes for the reasons we discussed earlier, right? But we have done also some work on benefits and that's published work. Now, on top of that, the other two types of studies that we do a lot of, one is basic epidemiology, so characterizing a condition. How often does this happen in a population? In the example I was mentioning, are we seeing, for instance, an increase in the incidence of a particular cancer in younger people, which we would be worried about? That sort of thing that we call characterization or descriptive analysis. And the third type is what we call prediction. So this is where we take a group of people and say, what happens to people when they get diagnosed with osteoarthritis? What are the people who are at the highest risk of having a knee replacement? Or what are the people who are at the highest risk of falling and having a hip fracture? So that would be prediction work.
Very interesting. Right. We'll get to COVID now. So can you remember where you were or under what circumstances you first heard that something was going on in China, and how soon did you realize that was going to fall into your area of interest?
Yeah, so back in December 2019, we were all hearing the news, right? it wasn't very solid data yet, so it was very hard to really figure out what was coming. But yeah, as an epidemiologist, I was kind of, you know, already paying attention to the information we were getting. In January, it was already very obvious that this was coming. You know, we were seeing images in China, you know, lockdowns, and we knew that there were still, you know, planes flying people around the entire world, pretty much, right?
And you were here in Oxford, but I forgot to pick you up on all your career steps. So
No. I've been here continuously since 2012.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, I guess between December and January that year, I still went to Spain for the Christmas break. That year, I managed to get there. But yeah, let's say from January, I was here. Mm. In January, I already saw there was a possibility that we might be able to contribute some work because of this collaborations that we have internationally. And I was very, very busy because we were due to host an international conference, my group and I, here at Oxford, where of course I was in touch with all these colleagues from, for instance, China or South Korea, who were saying we might not be able to travel.
Which month was that meant to happen?
Sorry,
which month was it meant to happen?
In March. So that was due to happen on the 20th, I think, of March. So, at that time already, you know, we were concerned, but yeah, it wasn't clear whether we would have cases, although, you know, we could see it coming, right? So we were already looking into what happens if we cancel, you know, do we lose all the money, and that kind of thinking of preparing for the worst. So that was January. And then in February, it was already very obvious that we had to cancel the conference, you know, the minute we saw what was happening in Italy and in Spain. And, you know, we have colleagues there who were working in the hospitals and telling us what was happening. It was
and
very
so Spain,
obvious.
I mean, we heard a lot. Italy was very high profile, but I don't remember hearing much about Spain. But did they also have a severe problem before it came to UK?
So Italy and Spain are very connected countries, right? Because they are, they speak very similar languages and there's a lot of mobility between both countries. So the minute it started getting a little bit better for that first wave in Italy, it started getting really bad in Spain, especially in big cities like Madrid and Barcelona. I think the first recognized case is 23rd, 24th of February in Spain. But yeah, like a week later, they were already, you know, thinking of locking down and so on. Mm. So it was, yeah, maybe a couple of weeks earlier than the UK when things had to be done very rapidly. And at that point, you know, it was very obvious to us who were talking to these people all the time. And I was also talking to people in Asia that there was no way we were going to dodge it. So, yeah, I guess that's the summary of those first very dark few weeks.
And I mean, one of the first responses, or a fairly early response, was the idea of trialing repurposed drugs. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you felt you could contribute to through your approach?
Yes. So at that time, already in late February, we decided we had to cancel that conference that I mentioned, and we decided that instead of doing that, we would have something that we're very used to now, but at the time sounded quite novel, a kind of virtual, we called it study-a-thon, which was basically let's gather all our colleagues internationally and hold, I think it was a four-day, you know, 24/7 activity, because of course you could have people awake during the whole day looking at a number of things. And the number of things we
and this was all online, on screen,
all
online.
On Teams, which at the time was you know, something we had not used that much. So we basically, you know, all the people who had registered for this conference, we had to tell we're going to cancel. And then we opened, you know, we told all of them, if you want, we are going to be hosting this event that's going to be online, and we're going to be working on research rather than meeting and discussing other things, which was the plan originally. And it was very nice to see, of course, you know, all these collaborators from around the world rallying together. This was with a community called ODYSSEY, Observational Health Data Sciences and Informatics, OHDSI, who were, you know, we were going to host the ODYSSEY Europe meeting, and these colleagues, you know, from all over the world said, yeah, let's work together on this. And then, you know, late February, we were writing already the protocols on the studies we wanted to do. And the most important ones were, first, really characterizing the condition, because there was a lot of uncertainty. You will remember some people were saying this is like the flu, and we published what I think is a seminal paper, the first international characterization of the condition, looking at people hospitalized with COVID versus people hospitalized with the flu in previous years, just to show the differences, right? We can get into the detail if you want, but that was a very important piece of work. Second piece of work was looking at repurposed medicines or medicines people were talking about. Because at the beginning we didn't have a lot of data on COVID patients, we were interested to learn on medicines that were heavily used, but maybe we didn't know so much about in terms of safety. Because again, you know, some of these medicines have been, I'm talking now hydroxychloroquine in particular, and we wrote a paper looking at some concerns with the use of hydroxychloroquine in combination with antibiotics, which is again another advantage of this data, is that you see everything that happens, right? It's not like a trial where you have one treatment only. In here, if someone is taking two or three, you see them in combination. And we found a very strong signal for a cardiovascular safety risk when people combined hydroxychloroquine with azithromycin, which is an antibiotic that was being heavily used at the time. And this made it, you know, all the way to the regulators nationally and internationally. There were changes in clinical guidelines, changes or, you know, letters sent to clinicians saying don't combine these two treatments. And that was using, not really using COVID patient data, this was using retrospective data, which we had available already. But there was indeed a plan then also to look at, once we had more data on COVID patients, look at whether the treatments also had any benefits, right? Because that was, of course, an important consideration. You need to balance risk and benefit. And the last bit of work was trying to identify who was at very high risk getting, you know, severe COVID when they got the infection, right? And that's, again, information we produced and we shared here nationally with you know, SAGE and the advisors of the government, but also internationally when anybody was interested, because we found that it was relatively straightforward to predict who was going to get in trouble based on, you know, 5-6 conditions, age and sex, right? As we probably know very well now, but at the time that was a big question.
And did ethnicity come up in that?
So ethnicity didn't come up in that first bit of work,
right.
Probably because we were mostly relying on data from countries where there's not a lot of variation in ethnicity. We had data at the time from South Korea and Spain, I think.
I see.
And, well, Spain has some more variation, but probably not for the ethnicities that lead to a high risk of severe COVID. And South Korea has very little ethnic variation. So we didn't see it at the time. But we still saw, you know, that we could predict very accurately who would get severe COVID based on 5, 6, 7 features. You could basically create a very simple, you know, equation and calculate your risk.
So things like age, obesity.
Age, sex, obesity, diabetes, cancer, hypertension. I think that was the list.
And was there any overlap between, or relationship between what you were able to do with databases and what the recovery trial was doing, which was a prospective trial of treatments?
Yes, so I think hydroxychloroquine is a beautiful example. We did observe, and this was already made available to key stakeholders in during that first week that we worked together with colleagues, so late March, very early April, we wrote already the manuscript with these findings that were very important. And I think, so that showed that hydroxychloroquine was not necessarily as safe as we thought. And especially when you combined it with these antibiotics, and, you know, people were using these combinations very often just to protect against bacterial pneumonia, and there was a lot of uncertainty. So if you remember, then in June, recovery showed that the treatment was also not effective,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So we knew by June, with two seminal papers from Oxford, that hydroxychloroquine wasn't a good idea because it wasn't as safe as we thought, and also it wasn't effective.
Yes.
So I think it's a perfect example of complementary information coming from these two types of data. And I think that was beautiful to observe how these, you know, different studies can complement each other.
And I mean, similarly, dexamethasone, which turned out to be of benefit, was that something that you were looking at in the data as well?
So dexamethasone, at that time, we were not looking at that because there wasn't a lot of use of steroids. I don't know if you remember, but there was a lot of, well, colleagues, because again, we had a lot of data from Asia at the time. The thing is, from the experience that colleagues from China and South Korea had from SARS 1981, so, you know, 20 years before, they thought that steroids were not a very good treatment for this condition, and they were not using it. So it's quite interesting how these things, you know, basically, yeah. So without, I guess, without recovery, we would probably have never recommended this treatment, because previous similar conditions had told us not to use them, right? Mm, mm. So it's great that that recovery happened, and we managed to see that. The only thing we did on dexamethasone was, and this is published in the BMJ, one of my students at the time, who is now a postdoc, Albert Prats, wrote a paper with colleagues from all over the globe looking at what treatments were being used routinely when people get admitted with COVID-19 during the first wave. And you could see a lot of variation, as you can imagine, but you could see things like this. You could see, like, in Asia, very, very little steroids, very, very little hydroxychloroquine. Other countries like the US were using a lot of hydroxychloroquine. Here in the UK was halfway through. So you could see this variation that usually demonstrates that you don't really know how to manage a condition, right? Mm-hmm. And then these different clusters of, you know, countries that do things similarly, which is quite interesting as well. And in there we saw for steroids in particular how, you know, very, very little use in Asia, more so in Europe and in the US.
Mm-hmm. And so, should I jump to vaccines, or was there another important study that happened before we had the opportunity to start thinking and talking about vaccines?
So I guess before we jump into vaccines, the other bit of work that was very important was this work on prediction, right?
Oh, yes,
so
yes.
Classifying again into these three categories. We found that it was relatively easy to predict somebody's risk of having severe COVID. And that was very important information, because some governments were planning, you know, shielding strategies or thinking how to roll out their vaccines when they were available. In the end, it wasn't rocket science, because it was relatively intuitive, I guess. Mm. But it wasn't quite like the flu. Like, if you try to see who is going to get very high risk of, you know, ICU or hospital admission with the flu, you get like two peaks with young children and elderly people. With COVID, you had, you know, children were okay. Very elderly people also had problems. But then you also had this group of people who were relatively healthy, but had obesity, diabetes, a very different metabolic profile that made them, you know, for some reason, prone to having very severe complications from COVID-19, and that was quite a finding. Then whatever people did with that information, different governments did different things, right? But I thought at the time that was very important information that we had to make available. And again, that I think informed some of the policies internationally.
Mm-hmm. And what was the mechanism? I'm quite interested in the kind of detail of how information flowed between researchers and government. Did you have a kind of hotline to the Department of Health that you...
So I guess there were a number of ways things happened. We were making all our data available in the form of preprints, mm-hmm. In MedArchive mostly. Mm-hmm. And some governments and some even international stakeholders, like the European Medicines Agency or the FDA, were very good at reviewing the literature every day and identifying studies that were relevant. And we would get, you know, an email saying, oh, we would like to know more about this. Mm. Or sometimes the manuscript had enough information. Then more nationally, I also had, been in touch with some of the colleagues in the Department of Health, and I was very closely talking to them and telling them, look, there's this paper coming in MedArchive tomorrow. See if it's of interest, and if you need any clarifications, let me know. So there was basically this, you know, more proactive or more reactive attitude, depending on the information you were producing, and I guess also the information that each country had already available, right? Because some countries were very data poor, whilst the UK was very data rich. So the Department of Health, I believe, had a lot of information coming from UK HSA as well as researchers from all over the country. So we were very proactive in providing the information, but I'm sure they had much more data than many other countries did.
So, it, At what point do you think it became obvious that there was going to be a vaccine, that it, you know, it was looking good? We hadn't actually got the results of the trials yet, but the possibility that there would be a vaccine within a year of the pandemic beginning was looking good. And did that influence your thinking about how to address that?
Yes, very much. So I think by the summer of 2020, which, you know, thinking about it, is quite early on.
Amazingly fast.
Yeah,
yes, yes.
Maybe of course because I live in Oxford, and then you, you know, of someone who is in a phase one trial. You know, like I had a neighbor who was one of the first 50 or 100 people who were testing one of the vaccines. Yeah, so we knew by summer 2020 that there were candidate vaccines that were, you know, going through a kind of a trial process. I don't think we knew exactly when we would have enough data to approve them, but we knew, you know, this was moving very quickly. So that, what that meant for us was that we needed to be prepared to help the regulators with their work on safety. Yeah, and when it comes to vaccines, safety is paramount because, you know, if you're giving someone who is sick a treatment, you're giving them that treatment to ail something, to improve their quality of life. With vaccines, we are basically trying to prevent something from happening, and typically not only in people who are at very high risk, but also potentially in very healthy people, right? So safety concerns are very important. And so the way it works with regulatory work is that once a product is approved based on the clinical trial data, there are all these commitments for post-marketing surveillance. And typically the first signals that the regulators get come from yellow cards, and that's that sort of information they call spontaneous reports. So this is patients or physicians reporting that something has happened. It doesn't need to be causal, but they just report something that wasn't in the label.
And it could be anything. It could be a sprained ankle.
It could be anything, yes, yeah. Yes. They just then need to look at the narratives in those reports and then assess, you know, if it's, let's use the sprained ankle example, is this happening more than for people who are being vaccinated with flu vaccines, for instance, right? So they do a little bit of what they call a disproportionality metric. Yeah, in any case, when they see something that they think could be potentially causal, they then, what they do is they look at previous knowledge on how often that thing, that event happened in the general population, and how often are we seeing that in the vaccinated population, and they compare both, right? And they do this type of analysis they call observed versus expected analysis, which I think is an intuitive terminology in this case. So, of course, to have an observed versus expected analysis, you don't only need the observed, you also need the expected, which comes from historical data, right? And although you think that we have information on the rates of any condition you can imagine, that is not true. There are many things that are very important for vaccine surveillance that we did not know quite how often they happened in the historical data in the general population. So we thought the first thing we had to do was basically do this very accurate analysis, stratifying, you know, into different groups of age and sex and so on how often do you see these conditions that were potentially identified as potential safety signals to keep an eye on before we had the trials, so that the regulators had all that information by the time the vaccines were approved.
And this is people who'd had vaccinations for other things?
This would be either people who had been vaccinated for something else, or in general in the whole population.
Oh, I see. Right.
So
yes,
if you want to say, oh, I'm seeing more blood clots in this population that has been vaccinated than in the general population, you need to know how often that happens in that general population. And that is not always available. Maybe for blood clots it was, but for other things it wasn't, because some of these things are very specific and not very common in general. And we did a piece of work, again, with this community, with the ODC community and colleagues across the globe, looking at basically estimating all these rates. We call them background rates or expected rates from historical data, 2017 to 2019, before the pandemic. And we had data from 16 or 17 countries that was published in the BMJ, and I know from, I've heard from regulators that they use that all the time, because that was the first point of contact. You know, when they were looking at blood clots, they would go and say, oh, what is the expected number? And they could do that calculation very quickly. And we did that for 15 or 16 conditions that they had, I think the FDA had listed as adverse events of special interest for surveillance of COVID vaccine safety.
So one of the other things I've heard people talk about is the anxiety that you might get an exacerbation of the condition with the vaccine, that it could actually make the symptoms worse. I've forgotten what the proper term for that is.
Yeah, there is a term for that, and I'm not. It's not quite getting to me now.
Yeah.
I know that is a concern. I think that was relatively clear. It was relatively clear early on from the phase two trials that was not happening for the vaccines that were coming up. So that's always a concern. But the good thing with that particular problem is that you typically find out very early on during trialing, because, you know, yeah. So having COVID, of course, is not a rare outcome, right? Mm. Compared to, you know, having a blood clot or something else. Mm. So that was, I think that was data that we didn't produce because it was already available in the trials. So that was the first kind of, you know, decision. We had to produce that data as early as possible. And then the other decision was to start preparing, identifying candidates across the world, but also across Europe more specifically, of people who we knew would have really good data on vaccine exposures. Yeah, so, you know, I'm talking about people around the continent and also in the UK who had access to data with, you know, vaccine brand, vaccine batch, because there could be issues with specific batches, you know, specific date when a vaccine was given. And that was, we knew it would be hard because we knew this vaccination campaign would be universal and people would be going to the Casam Stadium in Oxford or to the Camp Nou in Barcelona to get vaccinated, right? So it's not like we would just go to the GP records and find it there. We needed, you know, data sources that had that ability to link or to identify people getting vaccinated. And that is where it was very obvious that European data would be the best in the world for that because of the way we organize healthcare, right? So a country like the UK or a country like Spain that have universal healthcare systems where you can track a patient across the healthcare is much better than...
Because you have a unique number, an NHS number.
Because you have a unique number. And Scandinavia would be another example, right? Compared to, for instance, you know, in the US where people basically have a... health insurance, but then that doesn't always necessarily link to a vaccination in a stadium or in some sort of center. So yeah, we prepared for that, knowing that at some point there would be a vaccine safety issue and we would need to produce data. And if you want to discuss that in more detail, but that's, you know, the third bit of work that we did that was very impactful was investigating some of the events as they were observed by some regulators.
And those, so you were, once the vaccine rollout started, were you monitoring continuously in these, how does it work? Do you have software set up to pick out any of these signals that something's going on?
So that's the work that the regulators do.
Oh, right, I see.
They're the ones who typically will identify a signal, and usually that happens before in the spontaneous report data than it happens in the data I have access to. Mm. But what we have is software and colleagues that were capable of curating this data
all the time,
that when an issue happened, we had access to recent data. Because, you know, otherwise, you basically don't have enough information to do the research. Of course, the data that the regulators have, these spontaneous reports, are very limited in that, you know, they are low in numbers, they don't have enough information, they don't have a denominator, you don't know how many people look like that person that reported that problem. There are issues with completeness, not everybody reports when they have an issue, but they are very useful as a kind of signal detection system where you can pick up something that's surprising, right? And then we were basically ready to go the minute there was something that was indeed surprising to do, you know, a more elaborate kind of evaluation of that specific signal.
And how did that play out? Because obviously there was, I think everybody remembers that there was this sudden concern about the possibility of blood clots, even though the numbers were tiny, specifically in relation to the AstraZeneca virus vaccine.
So the blood clot one is one that I think we contributed a lot of data to. So there was, basically, I guess mostly the UK national regulator and the European Medicines Agency were the first ones to see this signal because these vaccines were not heavily used in the US initially. And then they basically, the minute they said there was an issue with that, we had the background rates that I mentioned before. We could see whether there was a very clear increase already. And we didn't see something very, let's say, spectacular. It wasn't something that, I mean, they were talking about something very clear from the spontaneous report data, but we were not seeing something that clear from our data, which was reassuring in a way. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, we needed to then say, okay, let's do a cohort study where we followed people up, you know, and observed how many of them had one of those blood clots in the first 28 days after a vaccine. And so we did that in collaboration with partners across Europe again. And we were the first to produce an international bit of work on that. Mm. That was the first bit of work, more, let's say, you know, rapid evaluation and using this, you know, expected, observed versus expected type of analysis. And then after that, we also said, look, if this signal is only observed for people vaccinated with these specific vaccines, why not compare them to the people vaccinated with the other vaccines to see whether, you know, they will be more comparable than comparing them to, you know, people from 2019, right? So that was the second bit of work that we also completed using data from, I think, 6 European countries and US. And that was published in the BMJ and very, very welcome. We did observe a little signal for thrombocytopenia, this reduction in blood clots, in platelet counts, and then a little bit of a potential signal for blood clots, which kind of, I think, you know, reassured us that the data we had produced before was in line with that as well. So that was for the blood clots. And the other issue that I don't think is entirely resolved yet is this problem with Guillain-Barré syndrome. I don't know if you've heard of this.
Yes, I have heard
of
it.
It's a neurological inflammatory condition. And there were some signals coming up again from spontaneous reports on Guillain-Barré, but also on encephalomyelitis, another inflammatory condition of a different part of the brain, and also Bell's palsy or facial paralysis. So we did an analysis of those three in data from the UK and Spain, which were the data we had more access to and you know, that were of better quality, and found in our analysis, which I think were quite accurate, we didn't find a signal for any of those three. But interestingly, we found that when people have COVID, their risk of having those conditions is increased by like threefold.
Oh, right.
Which I think was reassuring, because at the time, again, the counterfactual of not getting vaccinated was getting COVID, right?
Yes, I was going to ask you about that in relation to the blood clots, because you also looked at that, didn't
we
you?
We did look at that, and we saw a similar thing. I think we knew that already.
So the risk from getting COVID of these adverse events is much higher than the risk
much,
from the
much
vaccines.
Higher.
Yes.
I think maybe I didn't point that out earlier, because I think we kind of knew that, all of us who, you know, are clinicians knew that, because one of the reasons people were dying when they had COVID was blood clots, right? So we were very worried that, you know, people were scared of having a blood clot in 500,000 people, when actually when people got COVID, it was like 1 in 1,000 maybe, right? So that was, but in our paper, that's very, very clear. There's a, 5-10 fold increased risk of things like, you know, pulmonary embolisms or blood clots in your lungs with COVID, compared to a potential increase which wasn't even significant in this case when you had the vaccine. So the kind of risk benefit again, right? So the problem when you had the infection was much, much worse than when you had the vaccine.
But I guess in the public mind, having a vaccine is something you choose to do to yourself or have somebody do to you.
Yeah.
And in a way, you feel you've got control over that. You can make a decision whether or not to get it, and whereas catching an illness is just bad luck, I suppose. I don't know. I'm trying to account
for
the way people seem to be more fearful of possible risks from vaccines than they are of the disease.
So I guess my argument against that would be, actually, in a way, you are choosing whether you have the vaccine, and the vaccine protects you against the disease, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not only bad luck. It's also, if you choose not to have the vaccine, then you are much, you know, at a much higher risk of having a severe form of the disease, which is what leads to these complications. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we also did a study looking at what happens if you have COVID in the ambulatory setting, like, you know, in at home, right? Or in hospital, and it was the people who were in hospital that had a much, much, much higher risk of having blood clots when they had the severe form of COVID-19. So in a way, you know, I do appreciate what you mean. Like when you're basically putting your arm there to get a vaccine, people probably had this idea that, well, COVID is just bad luck if you get it. But basically there was this intervention that was preventing you from getting or at least clearly preventing you from having a severe.
I'm not saying it's rational.
No. I know how it works.
There is a kind of rationality about it, but it's
just this, you know, yeah, I guess as scientists, and especially in epidemiology, we always work with counterfactuals, right?
Yes,
we don't like to give you one number. We like to say, this is the number if you do this, but this is the counterfactual if you don't do it. So I think, you know, to us, it was important to produce this knowledge on what happens when people have COVID without being vaccinated, you know? And that was our thinking, both with the blood clot signal and with the neuroinflammatory signals. And again, with those, to my surprise, because I didn't know what to expect really, we did see again a very high risk of having these neuroinflammatory complications when people had COVID and were not vaccinated. So again, that was very reassuring data to say, if you're scared of blood clots or if you're scared of having Guillain-Barré, what you should do is actually get vaccinated.
Yes.
And that I think was important, not only to reassure the regulators and, you know, to inform future research, but also hopefully to inform the population of the importance of vaccines and getting vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. And have you looked at long COVID at all?
So that's an ongoing project we're doing right now. We are looking at whether, and this is an again NIHR, National Institute for Health Research grant that we got about, I want to say, 9 months ago, to look at whether being vaccinated prevents long COVID. Again, this is something someone could have looked at in the vaccine trials, but long COVID wasn't a concern when we did those trials. And, you know, it's going to be very hard to think that somebody will do a trial of vaccination versus not vaccination nowadays, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we are doing this with the kind of data we have information on.
Mm-hmm.
We are finalizing those analyses right now, so I'm hoping we will have results by the end of this month, but it's looking quite promising. I think we will have very, very good, very compelling evidence that vaccination is also a good idea to prevent long COVID, which is what we kind of expected, based on anecdotal evidence. But there is, you know, there's a systematic review of the literature by UKHSA showing that there is a need for this specific type of study, and that's why we are doing it.
So there's no question now. I mean, I think early on when long COVID was being talked about, I think even the term long COVID was developed by patient groups because there was a lot of scepticism in the medical community about whether it was real. And is that something your studies have addressed?
So this is something we have looked at already. What we've done, I don't think we can, with the data I have, I don't think we can look at whether long COVID is a thing, you know. I don't think that is something we can do. I tend to believe that if patients explain an experience, they are probably having it, so I never hesitated of that. But what's really important, I believe, and what we need, and this is research, all this research on long COVID, we've been working with long COVID patients very closely, so it's been very much informed by patients themselves. But one of the things was, you know, we have a list of 25 symptoms that the WHO identified as, you know, to be used as a definition of long COVID clinically. So this is what clinicians do nowadays, is they see whether people had those symptoms for more than 3 months. And if you have one or more of those for more than 3 months, then you officially have long COVID at that time.
And does it have a new, is it called post-COVID syndrome now or post-COVID?
Yeah, they call it PASC, right? Post-acute COVID syndrome,
right,
as well as, yeah, long COVID remains the I guess, yeah, less formal terminology, and the most official one is PASC. But yeah, there's this definition by the WHO, which comes from an expert group, and, you know, who sat together and said, this is what my patients have. And that's what we're using, but I think that can be refined, and the kind of data we have access to can be very useful to refine that. So before looking at, you know, do vaccines prevent long COVID, we did a lot of work to look at what does long COVID actually look like in the data. And what we did, which is quite interesting and has not been done before, and this is something that will hopefully be out in the literature very soon, because we've submitted the paper and everything, is looking at, okay, what happens if I get a person who had who tested positive for COVID, and I compare them to a similar person with the same age, gender, and so on, who tested on the same week but tested negative. Yeah, there are some of the symptoms that are listed in the WHO list, like anxiety, that I think all of us were probably experiencing to some degree when we were in the middle of lockdown, right? So we really wanted to see whether there was, which of those 25 symptoms are really different in the duration or the severity or the presentation in people tested positive versus tested negative who looked alike. And we've done that work, and we've, I think we're gonna provide very important information on what are the symptoms that are more differential. I'm not saying that patients with long COVID didn't have anxiety. What I'm saying is, if we know which of those symptoms are more specific, maybe is the word, to long COVID, that could help us do research on those specific mechanisms, right? So imagine if we just said, well, people with long COVID have 10 times more risk of having cardiac symptoms like palpitations, chest pain, and something else than people who tested negative. Clearly, there's at least a group of people who have a heart condition that should be investigated, right? Whilst if we say anxiety is not differential, for instance, then maybe that is not something we should be investigating so much. We should treat it, of course, because we should treat everyone with a condition. But I don't think that is then something we should think is involved in the etiopathogenesis, as we say, in the causal, in the mechanistic processes that happen before people have long COVID. So that's what we've done, and we're going to publish very soon. And it's very exciting to see how this kind of analysis can, you know, unravel new knowledge and new mechanisms to understand more about this condition that's intriguing and affecting loads and loads of people. In that analysis, we also looked at whether there was a, in a way, a wave of long COVID every time we had a wave of COVID, and whether that changed over time. And we did see that that was true for the first few waves, but it looked like at the end, like from Delta onwards, probably because people were already mostly vaccinated, we do see less of a wave of long COVID after each wave of COVID in the community. So that again is, I think, very important planning forward, right? And how many people can we expect will get long COVID after having COVID?
And do you still have questions to ask about COVID? I mean, I think we're being encouraged to think, oh, it's all finished now. But, you know, you look at the data and actually there are still quite a lot of people around who have it.
Yeah. So we are doing a fair bit of work on maybe smaller things now, maybe not such big data in terms of numbers of people, but richer data in terms of numbers of variables in a given data set. We're using a lot of UK Biobank data, for instance, now looking at genetic traits that are associated. We, for instance, published a paper showing that there are some genetic traits that predict who is going to have a blood clot after having COVID, for instance, which is very important because you could potentially consider doing prophylaxis, prevention of sorts in people who have genetic markers of high risk when they get COVID, right? So we're doing work on that. We're doing work on genetic markers of breakthrough infection, genetic markers of long COVID. So all of that is work ongoing in the team right now as we speak.
And in the meantime, you're still doing your predictive work or gone back to your predictive work on cancer?
In the meantime, the team is also looking at characterizing cancer, predicting cancer, and looking at the use of machine learning and artificial intelligence to classify cancer a bit better so that we can treat it more accurately, I guess is the way to say it. I mean, of course, the team has grown quite a bit. My team has grown quite a bit since the pandemic because, you know, the amount of work that we're doing is, I think, probably threefold what we were doing.
During and the as a consequence of the pandemic?
I would probably say so.
Yes.
Because, of course, all this work on COVID didn't exist, right? So we have to do that we were not doing before. And there was this deprioritization exercise that we did for a while where we said, well, the most important thing now is to figure this out. But now we have to go back to also answering other questions that matter, like, you know, this issue I was talking about in elderly people who are taking these medicines, right? So we are now, I think, trying to answer all those things in parallel, and that requires more resource. And we do have that.
But do you think the value of your own group and the wider global network has been recognise, has your profile been raised?
Absolutely,
which
yeah.
will help with getting more funding for future.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we have so in I was going to say in the middle of the pandemic, by the end of 2021, we had a very large European grant to look at this issue with cancer that I was mentioning. And more recently, just a year ago, we got a very large contract from Erasmus Medical Center and the European Medicines Agency to do this work on, you know, looking at the safety of medicines and so on internationally. So at the international level, 100%, very much increased. Mm. At the national level, I would say so as well.
And I mean, obviously your work, this question perhaps doesn't apply to you, because your work has always been very collaborative, nationally and internationally. But did you have the sense that working during the pandemic was that people were more prepared to collaborate and, you know, wanted to work together, and so that the normal kind of cut and thrust of academic competition was less of an issue?
Yes, definitely. I think specifically for, I mean, to be honest, at the beginning, COVID was not bringing any funding to anyone. We were just doing it because we had to do it, right? So when I was talking about, you know, growing the size of the team, at the beginning, it was basically the same people working more hours. So it wasn't a funding competition as such. It was more, you know, I guess, competition to produce useful knowledge.
Yes.
And I think, yeah, I want to be optimistic. I think the pandemic, in a way, catalyzed a move towards more collaborative work, at least in my field, in health data sciences, I would say. Probably, yeah, I think so.
Okay, we're going to come along to talk a little bit about how it impacted on you personally and how you work. So, I mean, first of all, how threatened did you feel by the virus itself, yourself, personally?
Yeah, so let's say probably because I had access to a lot of information, I was, I think, more scared than most of the population, much earlier than most of the population. I think this is a very nasty virus that before vaccination is still nowadays very risky and very dangerous. So, you know, not specifically because I have any particular condition or anything, but I knew it was a virus that was causing, you know, even in people like me, healthy and relatively young, a hospital admission in every 100, which is, you know, if you do the math, it's a lot of people in hospital, right? I am also someone who travels a lot for work, who interacts with a lot of people because of collaboration, who meets people in a room like this all the time. So at the beginning, when we were, you know, starting to say, okay, it's clearly here because it's Italy and it's in Spain, and we're getting, like, you know, hundreds of people moving in both directions every day, it was very scary because I was kind of very confident that I had all the chances to get it, and because there was this, you know, uncertainty on how long the incubation period was, I was also scared to pass it on to my, you know, partner and to my children, right? So it was very scary at the beginning, I think it was still scary for a very long time for me until we were vaccinated, and at that time I knew things were different, and we were moving into a completely new stage of the pandemic.
And did your team work at home mostly? Because, I mean, most of your work is with computers,
yes.
I understand.
It's most of the work.
There's no
exactly.
lab work, there's no patients.
Exactly. So so the only value, which is a lot, but the only value of being here in the Bodnar Research Centre where we work is that we meet all day long. We go to each other to ask questions. There's much more, you know, opportunity for solving problems together and for brainstorming and things like that. But the work can be done mostly online and from home, really. Mm. The minute we knew this was coming and there was going to be a lockdown, I basically told everyone, feel free to work from home. And, I knew the lockdown was coming and it was going to happen, you know, earlier or later, right? Mm. So we all worked from home. Mm-hmm. The team was impressive in how they worked and delivered everything despite the massive change and readaptation. I have a lot of colleagues who are, you know, from other parts of the world. Some of them went back home or, you know, where their families were, and that still worked out really well. I think it demonstrated the resilience of, you know, a team of people that really wanted to make a difference despite all the odds. For me, maybe getting a bit personal, but for me particularly, it was also a way to kind of keep busy, you know, sometimes feeling useful and probably as a physician myself, you know, feeling that you're doing something to help.
Did you consider going back into clinical practice?
I considered that every single day. And I hadn't been involved in the management of an acute patient for a very long time. So I knew I wasn't the best person to do that, really. And I knew that there weren't that many people in the world who could do the research we were doing. So I, you know, but I still every day, I woke up in the morning thinking, should I just, you know, go and help in the hospital, right? And there was a point in January 21 or December 20, maybe, when I was very close to saying, yeah, this is the right thing to do now. But yeah, I mean, I managed to help clinically in other ways. So I was helping with the rheumatology clinic here and all the junior doctors or younger people who probably are, you know, more up to date with the management of acute patients, despite being rheumatologists, were deployed in the COVID wards, and we were basically covering clinics. So that, you know, in a way, I was doing my bit clinically.
And did you have to get into full PPE and everything, or was it?
It was mostly
this
virtual.
Hospital a COVID-free zone.
This hospital, the Nuffield Orthopaedic Centre, is it was relatively a safe space all the time, but also a lot of the rheumatology work could be done online, because sometimes, you know, it's a consultation that's more about, you know, do you have inflammation in your joints and so on. I'm not saying it's the same as seeing a patient face to face, but, you know, again, considering the risks and the benefits of seeing someone relatively, you know, with on treatment with immune suppressants and the kind of treatment we use in the clinic wasn't desirable. Also, you know, most patients didn't want it either at the time. So yeah, you know, I had that every day, but in a way the amount of research I was doing was also so big that I was busy. I was working every single weekend, and
That was the other thing I was going to ask about, how your hours changed. I mean, I'm sure you worked long hours anyway, but
yeah, I mean, it's hard to say how many hours we work as academics, right? Because we don't have a kind of office, especially for us who are, you know, more senior. But at that time, it was crazy and unsustainable, clearly. It was just something temporary that we thought, I guess we kind of kept going because we thought it would be another 2 weeks and then it would be another 2 months. But I guess recognition should go to our families and the people who supported us during that period, because in my case, it was very, very crazy. I still remember the first time I was watching a movie on the weekend with my kids and feeling guilty that I wasn't working, you know. And that was like well into 2021 already. All the, you know, previous year and a bit, it was basically just work as much as you can, because this needs doing for yesterday. Everything COVID was urgent, right? There wasn't anything that you could, basically try and take more time to produce. So yeah, that was clearly unsustainable, clearly undesirable, but the only thing we could do at the time.
And you said, you hinted that the fact that you had an important project to work on did support your well-being.
Yeah, so for me it was important, and I think if you interviewed my partner, she would say the same. It was I also exercised a lot.
Yes, you were able to do that, yeah.
But it was clearly a mechanism for me to basically, you know, think more of the others than of myself, you know, and create this knowledge that was heavily needed, rather than worrying about, you know, what happens if I get the virus. Also, it's true that, of course, working from home as I could do for all the work that we were doing felt very safe, really, although sometimes boring and, you know, and not very interesting.
Yep, I think we've more or less got to the end. I think we've just about covered everything there. So, yes, final question. Has the experience of working on COVID-related research topics changed your thinking about how you work and what you do? And is there anything you'd like to see change in the future?
It has a lot. It has changed the way we do things in my team quite fundamentally, actually. So in the past, we were more reactive, and I think we are now much more proactive. Like, we want to make sure that instead of having a question and then writing analytical code to crunch the numbers, we now are producing software that will be ready to go to produce that data that we will need basically with, you know, a line of code and a click, rather than, you know, 3 days of work coding and then quality checking and all that. So we've moved into a space that probably is closer to, I guess, software engineering, where we try to have pipelines, as we call them, to be able to produce those data or that information very quickly in a very reliable manner, rather than being reactive and saying, oh, now we need to do this, let's see how we do it. So that's
so you've been able to find commonalities between different kinds of questions and,
yes,
and streamline your software.
And the standardization of data, the mapping of data that we discussed earlier, facilitates that a lot, because, you know, if you know that the data is always going to look like this, you can always write code towards that format, right? And then test it in different data sets and so on. So it has changed fundamentally the way we do you know, health data sciences, as we call them, to basically be faster and more scalable, if you like. Scalability is probably the word that we use in this community now.
Terrific. Thank you very much.